You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko te tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpere Thursday. My name is Joel and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producer Sanat. E whai ake nei, coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, regular Wire host Caden spoke to MP Shannon Halbert about four-year parliament terms, the High Court challenge against the de-establishment of Te Aka Whai Order, and the Public Services Commissioner investigating potential changes to several lived experience ministries. For International Desk, they spoke to Andre Fa'aoso from Yale Daily News about the current experiences of international students in the United States, especially as the Trump administration targets universities for funding cuts. Sanat, what do you have for us today?
For City Counselling this week, I spoke with Councillor Julie Ferry about a new plan that's up for limited consultation to build higher density housing within the city. I also spoke to the University of Auckland's Associate Professor of Pacific Studies, Gordon Nanao, about the upcoming Pacific Islands Forum and the surrounding geopolitical tensions between Pacific Island nations.
Hey, aho whakaaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wae mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Kaua e wareware e a hei ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō, hei a pakihiri rokiroki mā rongo I te pai, tukutuku o irirangi pōho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
A select committee report has recommended going ahead with a referendum on four-year parliament terms. The report also recommended standard four-year terms, which conflicts with the ACT Party's suggestions of flexible terms and stronger powers for the opposition in select committees in the fourth year of a government. Māori health providers have brought a case to the High Court asking for a declaration of inconsistency between the government's de-establishment of Te Aka Whai Order and Te Tiriti o Waitangi. This marks the first case where the applications are seeking a declaration pertaining to Te Tiriti, which has the potential to be constitutionally significant. And the Public Service Commissioner, Sir Brian Roche, is currently considering a major shake-up of several ministries, including those for women, Pacific peoples, disabled people and Māori development. Sir Roche has ruled out de-establishing any ministries, but hasn't ruled out absorbing them into larger ministries. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, regular Wire host Caden spoke to Shannon Halbert about all of these topics. They started by asking what the Labour Party stance is on four-year parliamentary terms.
Oh, we certainly support a four-year term. I have supported the first four-year term for a long time. At the same time, I'm really keen to see what New Zealanders think. It's quite common in supermarkets when people see me now, they say, oh, you know, we really need a longer term. And I support a referendum to go out to New Zealanders.
The Select Committee has recommended going ahead with a referendum, but has also removed some of the ACT Party's proposals, like giving the opposition more power in select committees in the fourth year. Do you support this assessment?
David Seymour's changes were quite confusing. I think any changes really just need to be simple for the New Zealand public. That is important. The goal is about ensuring that future governments are able to do the work that they need to. In 3 years, that becomes too short to achieve some of the long-standing outcomes that governments want to. 4 years would give us a little bit more time. When I look towards next year, I think, oh my gosh, it's been such a quick term, and next year is election year. I'm looking forward to that, but that does make it difficult in terms of achieving outcome.
Would you support a referendum being held as soon as alongside the next election?
I certainly support a referendum for a four-year term, and I welcome any safeguards and measures that come with that. People constantly ask me to extend the term. I think it's important that they get their opportunity to have their say too.
Do you support the High Court challenge over the disestablishment of Te Aka Whai Order?
Well, I wouldn't want to get ahead of what's formally before the courts, but I've been an advocate of Te Aka Whai Order for simple reasons, being that Māori health outcomes are much poorer than the average New Zealander. We need to address that, and Te Aka Whai Order was established to do just that.
The court hasn't granted a declaration of inconsistency against Te Tiriti before. Could this be a positive step forward for recognition of Te Tiriti?
Recognition of Te Tiriti is incredibly important in our way forward. We've seen the government take us backwards in that respect and remove Te Tiriti from legislation that the Labor government put in place. I will be watching carefully in this case. I think it will be a step forward if that is the outcome, but let's wait and see.
Will the outcome of this case influence whether or not Labor reinstates the Māori Health Authority if you are elected next year?
Well, at Waitangi this year, Chris Hipkins confirmed that he would re-establish Te Aka Whai Order. But there is some work to do because this government has taken us so far backwards. The question is, what would now be the starting point and how do we take that forward? But most of all, we know the critical challenge in health is to address the funding issue. We need more funding in health, particularly in Māori health, to address those inequities that we see.
Are you concerned about the Public Service Commissioner considering changes for a range of lived experience-focused ministries, including women, Pacific peoples and Māori development?
Like New Zealanders, I have incredibly low trust when it comes to the needs of Māori, Pacific women and our Takatāpui rainbow communities. Many of them have received a punch down by this government, and I wouldn't be surprised if they look to disestablish population ministries or ministries that advocate and represented for those that don't feel represented by government. So yes, I am worried about that.
The Commissioner has said the ministries would not be disestablished, but what do you think the likelihood is of these ministries being absorbed by larger ones?
Well, I have no trust when it comes to issues pertaining to Māori, Pacific, women and rainbow communities with this government. They have taken us incredibly backwards. They're not focused on the needs of many of our most vulnerable groups, and this is what both the ministries and these organisations do. If anything, they need to be bolstered, they need to be supported to improve outcomes for these particular groups. And so any integration into a larger organisation isn't going to achieve any better outcomes for them. They'll just continue to take us backwards.
The ACT Party campaigned on abolishing what they call demographic ministries. How much of a role do you think they are playing in these changes?
Well, we've seen that the tail has been wagging the dog in this coalition. The ACT Party and New Zealand First seem to outrun the Prime Minister, Christopher Luxon, and that's why we're going backwards on so many things. Māori, Pacific, women and rainbow communities are feeling the punch down from this government, and that's a result of both ACT and New Zealand First in particular and a lack of leadership from our Prime Minister.
You mentioned the need to bolster support for these communities. As far as I know, we don't have a ministry for rainbow peoples, but is that something you think is important?
I've always supported a better structural setup for our rainbow communities. If that's a ministry, great. There might be a starting point between where we are now and a ministry to get that underway. But what I want to see is more investment into supporting our rainbow communities. But this government has taken us particularly backwards in that area. They've underrepresented rainbow communities in the work that they've done. They've removed guidelines both in sport and in our schooling system. And so I want to ensure that those things do come back, that we are supporting rainbow communities, particularly our young people.
That was Labour's Shannon Halbert on 4-year parliament terms, the High Court challenge against the de-establishment of Te Aka Whai Order, and the Public Services Commissioner investigating potential changes to several lived experience ministries.
That was our weekly chat with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Auckland Council will go to iwi authorities, government ministries and local boards for consultation on a draft plan that is proposing to increase intensification in the inner suburbs and strengthen hazard rules for new buildings. Auckland's population will cross 2 million people in the 2030s. However, there is not currently enough housing available in the market to house everyone who calls Auckland home. This is exacerbated by affordability issues, where many renters and first home buyers are being priced out of the market. The Prime Minister also recently said that he wants to see consistent house price growth as the country grapples with a long-tailed recession. I talked to Councillor Julie Ferry about this new plan to zone for nearly 2 million new dwellings in the city and why it is that Auckland Council is pursuing this change in the current moment.
Can you just briefly explain the plan that's gone out for consultation on intensification?
So what's happened is that we've been wrestling for a long time with how to apply central government expectations around intensification across the suburbs. And the previous government, there was a bipartisan agreement between National and Labor to put in this thing called the Medium Density Residential Standards, which is known as MDRS. The idea of that was that most residential sections in suburbs could have three-storey dwellings built on them. That's what MDRS does. And so we had a plan change in the works called Plan Change 78, which has been delayed several times, in particular because of the floods, which would have brought in that MDRS and some other changes. And across the whole of Auckland would have provided for 2 million extra dwellings. Some of those would be apartments, some of those would be standalone townhouses, all sorts of different types. But the idea was that over the next sort of 30 years, you've potentially got 2 million extra dwellings. Of course, a lot fewer than that would actually be able to be built because of other constraints. But that's sort of the headline figure. Now, what's happened is that central government has said to us, actually, we've changed our minds on MDRS. You can opt out of MDRS and not have to have it. And I think generally people aren't that keen on MDRS. But you need to bring in a new plan change instead that will still meet the 2 million target. And so that's what's been worked on very, very quickly, because central government haven't given us a lot of time. And so that's called, at the moment, it's called the Draft Replacement Plan Change. At some point it will probably get a number. And so at the moment we've been allowed by government to only consult with local boards, iwi, ministries and adjoining councils for a couple of weeks before we have to vote on the 24th of September on whether to notify for public input the new plan or go, actually, no, we're going back to Plan Change 78, in which case we continue with that plan, which is going to be quite difficult because, particularly for my ward, there's large parts of my ward that Plan Change 78 doesn't zone, because they were under the light rail corridor, which of course is now not happening, but they were left unzoned in Plan Change 78. So don't know what we're going to do about those if we go back to Plan Change 78, rather than go forward with this new plan, which if we vote for it on the 24th of September, then goes out to public, full public open submissions and hearings and things like that.
So the MDRS is about medium density residential standards, and now the challenge posed is, can we achieve the same sort of capacity, housing capacity through zoning, through a different or alternative plan? Is this involving like zoning for high density buildings as well?
Yeah, so what's happened is that basically because we've removed that MDRS, then we have to find the capacity through other means. And in some cases, we've found that through putting in zoning for the light rail corridor, which up zones makes more intense, some parts of that area from what the unitary plan, the current rules allow for. So there's nothing in Plan Change 78, but there is existing zoning under the unitary plan. And then under the new plan, we, for example, allow, you know, six-storey buildings along parts of Dominion Road where that makes sense because there's good transport links, right, for example. Okay, so the previous zoning might have only allowed three or four storeys. We put that up to six in some places, and that gives us some more dwellings, right? That helps us to meet the 2 million target. But it's not enough. So we are looking at much higher buildings potentially around, in particular, some of the train stations. And the Minister has specifically named five train stations where we must go to 15 storeys. So that's around Kingsland, Morningside, and the new Maungafo station, previously known as Mount Eden. And around two more where we must go to 10 storeys, which is Mount Albert and Baldwin Ave. So there are other areas as well. And if you look at, there's a really cool map with hexagons on it that shows the difference between Plan Change 78 across the whole region and the new plan change, where the red bits are where we've gone up and the blue bits are where we have less intensity, so basically where we've removed MDRS, or where we've downzoned because of infrastructure constraints, in particular flooding risk, which is something we can't do under Plan Change 78. It's a really useful map. I'm going to put it up on my Councillor Julie Ferry Facebook page hopefully today. And you can see from it that the reds are along, for example, the Western Line and the Southern Line. And the blues, which is where we are going for less intensity than under Plan Change 78, are sort of those less well-connected areas, areas that flooded, that kind of stuff. So Plan Change 78, we couldn't do any downzoning at all. So that's another big difference, particularly for my ward, where we had a lot of flooding issues, that the new plan enables us to go, actually, hey, ordinarily, yes, this is on a frequent transport route. Maybe we'd put this up to six or eight storeys, but because of the flooding risk, actually we're not doing that. And indeed, in some cases, we're making it less intense than the unitary plan, which we couldn't do under Plan Change 78.
One of the things I'm interested in, and you can maybe help our listeners understand as well, is, you know, we have these pressures weighing on us, right? Whether that be, you know, climate-related pressures with flooding events or extreme weather events going to be happening more frequently into the future, a population that is increasing quite, not rapidly, but is going to increase to a point where we do not have the infrastructure or the housing ready to cope with that demand. And so I guess my question is, well, why there has been a delay in introducing higher intensification housing into Auckland's housing stock? I mean, I suppose we've sort of seen it coming for the last few decades as well, but the insistence of the city has been to spread out as far and as wide as possible. Why has that been the modus operandi instead of what's being proposed in this plan?
Well, first up, I have to say we don't have enough housing now because we actually still have a housing crisis. We still have people living in cars and garages, couch surfing. We have a lot of hidden homelessness, particularly amongst women, people living in overcrowded conditions, having to stay in housing that's not right for them. So we already have a shortage. And I do get annoyed at colleagues who are like, no, we've got enough housing, we just need to have fewer people. And it's like, that's not how this works, right? We can't put, and we shouldn't put a wall around Auckland and go, hey, we're full, no one else is coming in. That's just, you know, not how humanity works, right? And it's not fair on people who already don't have the quality housing that they need and deserve. Everyone should have a right to housing. So why haven't we done this sooner? I think it absolutely comes down to political will. In the first Auckland plan, which, if I recall correctly, was done about 2012, there was a general political agreement at the time that we should try to have a more compact city. And through sort of the last 15 years, there have been various points at which there has been a high-level political agreement to do things like a 70-40 split. Now, 70-40 doesn't add up to 100, but the idea was that 60 to 70% of new housing should be in the existing urban area and as much as possible close to the city centre, close to amenity, and then 30 to 40% would be sprawl on new on greenfields. To my mind, that is still too much sprawl. But what we have seen when we actually get down to voting for plans that deliver that ideal. Is that there has been a lot of reluctance from my colleagues past and present to actually do the upzoning to enable more housing closer to the centre and in existing urban areas. There's also been a lot of pressure from developers to develop greenfields, and it's been really interesting to watch. This term there has been more pushback where, for example, Watercare have come out with really clear capacity maps that go, hey, if you want to build in this area, we cannot service you with a sewer system until, you know, 2032, for example, I think it is in parts of the Hibiscus Coast, when we will have built this new sewage plant. But until then, you don't get a resource consent if you want to build a house here because we can't deliver the sewage system unless you build a septic tank, which you're then going to have to maintain yourself. And that's getting a lot of pushback. People are going, well, hang on a second, I should be able to build on this land that I've bought to build a house on, and you should be putting in a sewer line. But we're having to go, well, actually, the cost of that infrastructure, building new infrastructure is always going to be more expensive than retrofitting infrastructure where we already have it, and that's without taking into account the increased transport emissions, the increased carbon emissions from building further and further away as well. So I'm a really strong supporter of more closer in. But I'm not always in a majority around the table.
That's really interesting. You talk about political will. I mean, there's, I guess, another part of why that attitude exists is because there's an electoral landscape in this country, but also in the city, where people rely on their house price appreciating over time, right? Yeah. And the result of that is if we build in suburbs that, you know, have people who have very good house prices that have been growing over time, that might seek to depress those house prices because of, you know, the added supply. And that's part of the opposition here. I mean, the Prime Minister has just come out and said that, you know, he wants to see consistent house price growth over the next few years. Is there a palpable tension there? I mean, coming into local elections as well, is this an issue you foresee having to contend with?
Yeah, I mean, one of the political realities is that we have no renters around the governing body table. Everybody owns their own home now. The last renter was Jo Bartley, who's great. She managed to buy a home using a shared equity scheme through the Tamaki Regeneration Company just recently in her 50s. And otherwise, she's been a renter her whole life. But she has brought that perspective to the table, and I really appreciate that. But otherwise, the governing body members, your councillors, we are the property owning class, and some of us own a lot of properties. Or it's a long, long time since we rented, and the rental market is very different now than it was when I rented, 20 years ago. So the importance of having either those voices directly or people who will seek out those voices and make sure they are heard at the table and in our processes, that we are becoming a city of the haves and have-nots. And then when you look at the voter cohort as well, only sort of 30-35% of Aucklanders actually vote in the local government elections. And we know that people who own property are much more likely to vote and much more likely to be aware of things like their the size of their rates bill, the value of their house, and be very sensitive to things that might change that, because in a lot of cases it is their primary asset, it is their retirement savings. So it does really, I think, result in a sort of misshapen a conversation about housing supply and the types of housing that we need and where we need them to be that isn't necessarily reflective of the whole city and all of our residents and what they need for the future. And I'm really hoping that this new plan stimulates more conversation and more discussion that I've been sharing across the various suburb Facebook groups in my ward, the new map and the old maps, so people can sort of hopefully be a bit better informed. But I am getting people who are going, oh no, more housing in my suburb, I don't want that because it means shade of my house, could mean shade of my house, even though there are actually rules in this that hopefully prevent a lot of that. And then I've got other people going, bring it on, we need more housing. People who have experience of living in apartments, for example, who are saying, yeah, I'd love to live in an apartment in my neighbourhood, but there aren't any now. So hopefully it's stimulating more discussion and more awareness of people's different needs and different views, that it's not all, hey, we have to stop intensification and set the city in amber, because cities have to grow and change. That's a healthy city. And the more housing we have that keeps our people safe and warm and dry and hopefully living in situations where they don't have to own a car to participate and they can access what they need, that for me is the vision for the city, not keeping things the same.
I suppose that's really important when we consider the fact that so many New Zealanders, but particularly young Aucklanders, are leaving to countries like Australia or even the UK, maybe even Asian countries, where apartment living or, medium density, high density living is kind of a norm, right?
Yeah.
Do you think that this plan might do enough to keep young people here and continuing to contribute to, not only the lifeblood of the city, but also its economic growth and its future?
I think it's absolutely vital. I mean, my eldest is 17, and he has said to me numerous times over many years, actually, because he's that kind of kid, that he doesn't expect to be able to buy a house in Auckland in his lifetime. And I mean, he's probably going to have access to help from the bank of mum and dad when that comes around, because, we can probably do that. Probably be the bank of Nana, actually. But anyway, that's not the reality for a lot of people, particularly people whose own family are renting, right? The cost of housing, we talk about a cost of living crisis. A lot of that in Auckland is housing. And it is driving people away, in particular young people, because also they can often earn more overseas. Cheaper housing, it's often more easy to travel and see the world from overseas. We are kind of the hardest place to explore from. And sometimes the weather's better, so my husband's family, most of the cousins in his generation, so I'm talking about my generation, have moved to Australia. A lot of my friends have moved out of Auckland for housing, so they've moved to Tauranga or Hamilton or Christchurch because they couldn't afford housing here, and that's my generation. So, the next generation coming along, I think it's a huge risk. We risk hollowing out a lot of these suburbs. In fact, it's already happening. So Grey Lynn School, for example, their role has dropped enormously because families can't afford to live in that suburb. It's a great school. There's no issue there, but they can't get kids in the door because there simply aren't families who can afford to live in that community. And what that does to a community as a whole, where you don't get that vibrancy, you don't get that mixing of people at different stages and ages in their lives. One of the other advantages that having more apartments and more in different types of housing will mean is that as people's lives change and they need different housing, they can stay in the same suburb. They don't have to move away to find the type of housing they need. And that means they can continue connection, less loneliness, all of those advantages. So for me, yes, for young people, but also for older people too, this brings a lot of advantages. And I think also people have a mental picture of high density like Hong Kong or Singapore. that's not what's being proposed here. And I do get a bit annoyed at people who you know, say that's going to happen on all of our suburbs. The city centre may become more like that, but it's going to take decades, and it's a long time before we're going to have that. This is more going to be genuine medium density with a little bit of high density in our town centres over the next 10, 15, 20 years.
That was Councillor Julie Ferry about a new plan that's proposing to add an additional 2 million dwellings to the city's housing stock with specific density around new train stations and inner suburbs.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
The Wire.
We'll be right back. Text 5395 any of your thoughts on these pieces.
A musical journey awaits you at Frida Margolis with a performance of The Amber Temple.
Creeping up and down your spine.
Witness music and dance colliding as singer-songwriter Julian Temple and contemporary dancer Amber Stevens draw the audience into a world of mystery with curious characters and strange events. The Amber Temple, Frida Margolis in Grey Lynn, Sunday, August 31st, and at Sawmill Cafe, Saturday, September 6th. Pre-sales available now at Under the Radar.
One of Aotearoa's most beloved artists, Bec Runga, is set to deliver an exceptional evening of music and song, Saturday, September 6th. Catch Bec performing songs from her bountiful catalogue, reinterpreted for orchestra and presented together with the majestic Auckland Philharmonia. Don't miss the inimitable Bec Runga, live for one night only with the Auckland Phil, Saturday, September 6th at the Artea Centre. Tickets available now from aucklandphil.nz.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
What if you call it?
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive. Thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
The Exploding Rainbow Orchestra is back. This November, the 35-piece psychedelic ensemble will be joined by guest performers Bailey Wiley, Crystal Chen, Damn Native, Hina, Jess B, Dateline's Katie Everingham, Lady Hawk, Liao, Lee, Red Fountain, Ruben Scott from Saltwater Criminals, and Steve Abel. The Exploding Rainbow Orchestra, Songbook Volume 4, November 4th, 5th, and 6th at Whakamana Cannabis Museum. Tickets from Moshtix, proudly presented by 95BFM.
A doco about Shane Carter, with archival footage from Flying Nun, plus interviews from other Kiwi music icons, and narrated by Carol Hirschfeld. Whoa!
We thought it ticked just about every box of things B-card holders would be into, so we have a double pass to the movie for you to win. Life in One Chord, a portrait of Shane Carter, directed by Margaret Gordon, in cinemas September 4.
Fire on the street.
That song there was Nurses by Dick Move. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
International Desk on our go.
The Trump administration's crackdown on both tertiary education and immigration is creating an uncertain environment for students in the United States, particularly international students. The administration has both delayed and removed student visas, introduced travel bans, and detained students involved in pro-Palestine protests. It also comes as the administration has slashed research funding, rolled back protections for disadvantaged student groups, threatened lawsuits against colleges, dismantled the education department, and more. For International Desk, Wire host Caden spoke to Yale Daily News' Andre Faorso about what it's like to be an international student in the United States right now. In a recent interview he did for The Guardian on the same issue, Faorso stated he was going to leave the United States as soon as he finished his degree. They started by asking what was motivating this.
I think definitely the current state of immigration in the US is a big determinant of that. But also I think the current culture and ongoing risks of being an immigrant in the United States have definitely been really big dissuading factors for me to find opportunities in the United States. Also, there has been a considerable shift in the positions of even employers in the US. So the job market for international students is going to become even more challenging because they now have to assess the additional cost or burden to hire an international student rather than to hire a domestic student, because there's a visa sponsorship and there's even smaller pathways to visa sponsorship nowadays too, or there's even discussions of that. Trump has, and people in his cabinet, have been discussing overturning certain bits of the immigration policy for F1 students, which is the undergraduate visa which I'm on, to pursue optional practical training, which is basically a job during breaks. And so there's that practical factor for me of like job security, and that is really shifting me to look elsewhere, particularly coming back to Aotearoa or going to Australia, or even somewhere in Europe. But there's also that underlying cultural and like belonging factor, I think, too. I just can't deny the fact that, you know, I went through the US border 3 or 4 days ago. And I mean, it went, for all parts, it went totally fine. But there was that nervousness for, you know, on account of all the horror stories that I've read and that I'm pretty sure everyone in New Zealand has been familiar with, of a growing number of Kiwis that have been subject to scrutiny at the US border.
Is this sentiment something you were noticing amongst other international students?
Yeah, absolutely. I think international students that I've spoken to, but also, you know, in the other Guardian article, there were some Iranian international students which are interviewed that, you know, they can't even enter the United States. And in many respects, they feel like they're being turned away at the door, even though all they want to do is come and pursue an education and contribute to the United States. So it is scary, it is unfortunate, I think, especially for the United States from a cultural perspective and for university campuses, but then also to the United States economy, just because, you know, $44 billion is what recent estimates have found that international students contribute to the US economy. And so this could be a significant loss if numbers go down in the way that they're anticipated to under the current immigration strategies. And yeah, international students that, you know, I've interacted with, there is a concern that their position in the US is jeopardized, and a lot have actually chosen not to speak out vocally and have actually decided to take those active steps to ensure that they can't be targeted for their political opinions or perspectives.
You've touched on this a little bit already, but there are stories of qualified international students who are not even getting their visas granted. Is this something you have seen or heard about?
It's something that I've seen and heard about in a distance, but I don't know or have not heard of any instances of that occurring at Yale. I know at other Ivy League colleges that has been an issue. I know Harvard and Dartmouth are two that I know of. There's even, in the case of Dartmouth, there was a Palestinian student who got admitted into the Dartmouth class of 2029. But because of the current bombardment in Gaza, he hasn't been able to secure a visa interview, let alone get an internet connection to get the interview or even to get the documents to apply for his visa. And so I think that's a pending case and ongoing, and there have been calls, you know, across the academic realm, not only in the Dartmouth students' instance, but, you know, for students belonging to travel ban countries, that it is a risk. I was actually, I was in London for summer school, and there was a student that I met from Venezuela who studies in Florida. And she was telling me that because Venezuela is a country that has undergone Trump's travel restrictions, that she was advised not to leave the United States because of fear of not being able to re-enter. And that's a big consideration which international students have been asked to bring in when they decide to plan for travel in and out of the US, is whether they are willing to take the risk because it's not guaranteed whether they'd be able to get back in.
At the same time as all of this, the Trump administration is cutting funding from universities. Can you talk a bit about the impact of this?
Yeah, so on part of the Trump administration's attack on diversity, equity and inclusion, but then also freedom of academic thought, some people would object, the Trump administration has cut hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars to funding across universities, mainly publicly funded universities, but privately funded universities or private universities that secure government funding have not, you know, dodged the bullet in that regard. Columbia University being one of the high profile cases, which had to actually succumb to the Trump administration's demands. Some of them included enacting or implementing stronger or more rigorous anti-Semitism policies off the back of the pro-Palestine encampments that took place on campuses across the United States last year. But then also to do with rhetoric and policies that existed in universities around diversity, equity and inclusion, which, you know, universities have been asked or have been ahead of time rolling back all their rhetoric and all their wording on their websites and in their policies about diversity, equity and inclusion. And it is a really concerning shift. Even at Yale recently, the cultural houses and cultural groups came out and submitted an open letter to the university, citing concerns that the university, at least in Yale's instance, are not supporting minority communities on campus in the way they should be, in light of the Trump administration's rollback on funding, but then also the targeting of diversity, equity, and inclusion. So those are the two big things that the Trump administration is targeting. Also, the other concern is the rollback on medical research and funding in some of these big university medical schools and what that might mean for the frontier of medical research, which is, you know, when RFK is talking about making America healthy again, but the defunding mRNA vaccine research, that's a big risk, especially in light of the COVID pandemic, which was only just 5 years ago.
As you say, some universities, like Columbia, are attempting to broker deals with the Trump administration to restore their funding. What has the reaction to this been from students?
There has been significant backlash, especially at some of the concessions that these universities have been willing to make. Some people would say that, you know, universities as the likes of Harvard and Columbia have somewhat folded to the Trump administration's demands and at the cost of academic freedom, but then also freedom of speech. And so in terms of student backlash, that has been unequivocal and has been very strong. Whether universities have been receptive to those calls, obviously not, because they've been willing to concede to the Trump administration. But it really is a case of cost benefit when it comes to the mindset of universities. It's what can we do to secure the funding to ensure that we can continue operating as an institution? And so even in Yale's instance, it's been balancing that. And also universities have been very active in lobbying on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. To ensure that policymakers are voicing the concerns of academic institutions, but that also, you know, the Trump administration is held accountable as much as possible on their attacks on institutions and what it means for academic thought or freedom of speech on university campuses. But then also even, you know, regarding the international student community, which I'm a part of, the safety of international students. Luckily, yeah, in the Yale's instance, there's, since it is a private university, we have our own police on campus. We also have our own security. And so amidst the whole ICE risk, the university has said that they will not let ICE on campus. But that isn't the case for publicly funded universities. They often have to cooperate. Otherwise, they are subject to significant funding cuts. And that's been one big leverage point that the administration has been using since it came into power.
That was Andre Farr, also from the Yale Daily News, on the current experiences of international students in the United States, especially as the Trump administration targets universities for funding cuts.
The International Desk on 95BFM.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back. That was Drowned by Roy Irwin.
I'm not sure of our position on that particular bill, so I can't comment on that right now.
It's a kind of bird. This is the bird they're endorsing for Bird of the Year.
The Wire.
A meeting of all major Pacific nations is happening in the Solomon Islands next month. The stability of this conference has been threatened by renewed geopolitical tensions in the Pacific, with China and the United States fiercely competing for influence.
New Zealand recently also withdrew funding from the Cook Islands, who have signed a multitude of bilateral deals with China that brings the nation in closer cooperation with the Asian superpower. Tuvalu previously threatened to boycott the conference as the US, China, and Taiwan, which are partner countries, have been banned from participating amid rising geopolitical tensions, but has since said that they will attend. I wanted to understand a little bit more about the importance of the Pacific Island Forum and the role that New Zealand plays in the Conference of Nations, especially in a Pacific environment where climate change threatens the sanctity of so many Pacific Island communities. Could you maybe just briefly explain exactly what the Pacific Island Forum is for our listeners?
Pacific Islands Forum was established in 1971, and the purpose of that organization was to have a forum where newly independent states of the Pacific can discuss political issues. And the reason for that was because the SPC, which is the South Pacific Commission at the time, was not a place where they can discuss political issues. So it was established for that purpose. And New Zealand and Australia, Cook Islands, Samoa and others were the initial founders of the organization. And if my guess is right, it was after a meeting in Wellington in 1971 that it was formally established.
There has been some tension in the lead up to this Pacific Islands Forum, with some countries like Tuvalu formally threatening to boycott, but now attending the forum because the Solomon Islands wanted to exclude donor countries such as the US and China. But there's also been a spat, sort of foreign policy spat, between New Zealand and Cook Island over deals, infrastructure deals with China. Could you maybe give us a little bit more context into what's happening in the Pacific geopolitically and what might be brought up at the Pacific Islands Forum this year?
I think as we all know, there is this geopolitical tension because of the increasing influence of China in the region. I think in 2019, Solomon Islands and Kiribati became diplomatic partners of China instead of, or they shifted from Taiwan. So in the process, I think many more Pacific Island states, they are now diplomatically connected to China rather than Taiwan, and of course that is a concern to Western allies, who are traditionally the main players in the Pacific Islands region.
Is the competition, the increasing competition in the Pacific between U.S. and China, a threat to Pacific unity? Maybe. Do you think there are camps or sides that are forming in that geopolitical conflict?
I think the difficulty at the moment is that increasing influence, but also there are lesser number of Pacific states that have diplomatic relations with Taiwan. So I think there are only three Taiwanese allies at the moment in that forum family, and therefore there is that feeling as well that maybe the majority are pushing away Taiwan and replacing that relationship with China. And of course, in the broader scheme of things, the traditional allies, led by the U.S., are also concerned that, with the Chinese increasing influence in the region, they have a lot of concerns regarding issues like security and those kinds of issues. So I think that's where the tension is at the moment.
I suppose one of the other key issues that the Pacific Island nations are particularly concerned about is the vulnerability to climate change and climate-related disaster over the medium to long term. Is the Pacific Islands Forum, you think, doing enough, or are these nations able to collaborate effectively in order to develop a response, especially in an environment where, the U.S. As a traditional ally is now not actively aiding countries outside of its region to combat things like climate change?
Yeah, it is, I think, a concern over the years, because for the forum island countries, the small island countries, their number one security concern under the 2050 strategy and in many of their documents is climate change. And that's the number one security threat for them. And it's something that they are concerned about, because obviously if you go to the lower lying islands of the Pacific, it is actually an existential threat. and it's, you know, perfectly understood that they would be more concerned about climate change. But, you know, the difficulty now is, you know, with traditional allies like the U.S., as you mentioned, not supporting that cause. So it's, yeah, if you like, that's a complicated space that they have to, you know, spend more time discussing. And for the Pacific Forum member countries, that is a big, big issue. But as we all know, America or the U.S. and other bigger countries are not concerned about it as they used to under the, you know, Paris Agreement or other previous global arrangements.
New Zealand has put in a bid to host the Pacific Islands Forum in 2027. What do you see as the future of New Zealand's participation in this multilateral relationship across the Pacific?
New Zealand throughout history has been very supportive of Pacific Islands Forum. And as I've said earlier, New Zealand was one of the founding members of the forum. And I think they also have a very good relationship and at the same time an image out there in the islands as New Zealand being a very supportive state. So I think depending very much on the outcome of the, you know, the upcoming or the forthcoming forum meeting in the Solomons, I think things will, as the host in 2027, I think they'll, I have a feeling that it will just continue the discussions to progress what they would have agreed on in the forthcoming meeting. So there may be comments or, you know, discussions here and there or reluctance to attend and so on and so forth. But knowing the Pacific Islands Forum and the leaders that are there, there's always an emphasis on consensus and relationship building. So I don't really see problems moving ahead. I think all they need at the moment is to get their house in order, the forum organization in order, and then be ready to face the future and also to engage well with, you know, with partners in that geopolitical space that we talked about earlier.
That was the University of Auckland's Associate Professor Gordon Anau on the 2025 Pacific Islands Forum.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I korero mai ki moa mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rāpiti Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakaronga ana, thank you for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, Labour's Shannon Halbert, Auckland Council's Julie Ferry, Yale Daily News' Andre Fa'aoso, and the University of Auckland's Gordon Nano. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Sophia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.